The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's January 14th, 2007, and you're tuned in to the RetroBits Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Earl Evans, and this is the show where we talk about computing like we did it back in the day. That's right. Here we're all about old school computing and modern day fun. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch cards, CPM, cartridge slots, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you've found the right podcast. This is show number 72, and today's topic, an interview with Rob O'Hara, part 2. Information about the RetroBits podcast can be found at our podcast hosting site, and that URL is RetroBits, that's RetroBits, .libsyn.com. If you'd like to send us email, the email address here is RetroBits@gmail.com, and if you'd like to join in on our online interactive discussion forum, you can find that at RetroBits.petsky, that's P-E-T-S-C-I-I. .com. Well, hey there, everybody. Oh, it's a cold one here in Portland, Oregon. Now, depending on where you're at in the world, you may think I'm just a wimp. In that the temperature is, I think, you know, 20s, 30s kind of thing going on here, but it's cold for me. Oh, it was just so funny. I was out with the family today. We pulled up into a parking lot and we got out of the car, and there in the parking lot, somebody had dropped a soda, you know, a soda cup, with, you know, the contents spilling out, except instead of drying up or going all over the place, the contents of the soda had just kind of frozen in place. You know, there's these little frozen trails leading out from it. I was like, oh man, it is just cold here, but nice. I mean, sunny, beautiful blue skies. Can't complain about the sunshine, you know, which we don't see as much as we would like sometimes here in the Pacific Northwest, but along with that sun is not coming any temperature. Anyway, I'm going to get right into the show today, again, skipping over the email in the news section, in that the interview that I have with Rob O'Hara here, I want to be able to bring all of it to you without cutting any parts. So I'm going to jump right into it. Now, to refresh your memory, this is part 2 of 2. An interview with Rob O'Hara, who is the author of Commodork, Sordid Tales from a BBS Junkie. Rob was kind enough to spend some time with us here over the telephone on an interview, and it's just some fantastic material. So without any further ado, because like I've said before, we all hate ado, here is part 2 of the interview, and afterwards, I'll be back to wrap it up. So, you know, speaking of hardware, another question that I'd had when I was reading in your book about Commodore drives, you know, they're famously slow.
Oh, yes, yes.
So if you guys were having copy fests with Commodore drives, what in the world did you do? Did you have hardware speed-ups like Jiffy DOS or, you know, how did you work it?
Most of the time you just set aside an evening. You know, even if one guy had a fast drive, if he didn't have two or three, it didn't matter, you know. So it was kind of the lowest common denominator. Now, I think it was pretty much a given back then that everybody had a fast load cartridge, either, you know, an Epix fast load or, you know, later on there was a lot of different, the first crack type cartridge that I ever saw was IcePick. The thing about IcePick was it was really good at what it did. It would take, you know, whatever you had in RAM and you could, you know, flip this switch, and then it would take it and copy it, you know, to the cartridge, and then you could dump it, you know, to another disk. But it didn't offer all the other features like the fast loading and the easy utilities and stuff like that that was built into the, you know, to Epix fast load. But later on, other cartridges like the Final cartridge, that was a real big one for us. You know, you could do all those things. It had, you know, built-in monitor. It had the fast loading stuff, but it also had the, you know, crack type tools. So, yeah, you had to have something like, I would never use a Commodore without some sort of a speed-up cartridge, for sure.
And I just got, somebody's trying to call me, so I just got the call waiting beep.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about it, folks. This is, you know, as close as you're going to get to live radio. So.
Technical difficulties.
Call waiting beeps and all. So when you were in on this scene, what was it that kind of kept the energy flowing? I mean, we talked about the collecting and that before, but I mean, that really must have kept you driven, because especially when you talk about the lengths that you took to get a functional BBS up and running and all the things you did to optimize that and the amount of storage that you had, you must have had something, you know, that was keeping you jazzed about the whole thing.
I think that, like I said, it after a while, it wasn't about the software anymore. It was just about what that software represented. And in the whole BBS scene, and even to a certain extent what's out there today, you know, the basically, you had two things. One would be the size of your software collection, and the other one would be the newness of your programs, you know, like how quickly you had things. And based off of those two things, if you had a lot of software and a lot of it was new, then you had power. And it sounds kind of weird because, you know, we're really talking about this virtual world. So, you know, this power, or whatever you want to say, whatever elite social status that these things would give you online did not translate over to the real world.
Right.
I was not getting dates because I had a lot of Commodore games, you know. It
right,
worked that way.
But no, I know what you mean, within the realm.
Right. And so if people had other things, you know, that you wanted or needed, I had people offer me hardware for my BBS. You know, I had people say, listen, you know, I get a lot of software from you, but it would be better if you had a bigger hard drive. So, you know, maybe I could donate you a hard drive. Or, you know, the friend of mine that ran the BBS that I started with, a guy that went by The Boss, I was keeping his BBS, you know, stocked with brand new programs. And after a while, he said, listen, you know, I'll cut you a deal on a faster modem.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, those things, it did get you things in that world. But so really, you know, after a while, like I said, it's almost like after a while you just start going through the motions. You know, every day I had the places that I checked for new software. Every day I had, you know, people that would call my BBS and upload. And after a while, you don't even look at the stuff that's going through anymore. It's just like, you know, a big machine, really. And that's, you know, later on, that's kind of when I started losing interest, when I realized that, you know, there was so much software going through my hands that I wasn't even looking at, and it had been so long, you know, since I'd even played a game at that point. And now it's kind of gone full circle, because now that, like I said, I just recently got a PlayStation 3 and went and bought a couple of games, and I've just been, you know, playing those all night long, you know. So it's really just kind of, after a while, you just get burned out. It's like collecting something that you don't care about after a while.
Right. Well, with a PS3, you know, that's some pretty stiff competition to your vintage collection.
You know what? I've had this debate with people online before. I really, really don't think that, you know, the graphical power and everything else that the latest consoles have, I still don't think that makes games any more fun. I still play Realm of Impossibility to this day. I still play Paradroid. You know, I still play those old games that I love, and I think that they're just as fun as anything that's coming out now. The new stuff is so complicated, you know, and like I said, when a game costs $60, you know, they really want to have, you know, they really want you to get your money's worth, but the problem is like you, I've got a couple of small kids, and I have a wife, and I have a job, and I really don't need a game that's going to last 60 hours.
Right. If I can...
It's going to be 6 months, you know? So, yeah, some of those, the Commodore and the Atari and the Apple had games that you could sit down and pick up a game and play it, and it would be fun, and, you know, when you were done, that was it. You could go on to another game, but, you know, there were no... there's no tutorial at the beginning of Donkey Kong that lasts half an hour so that you'll learn the controls. You know? They were just pretty instinctive to pick up these games and play. And I think that's something that's been lost in this big, you know, horsepower race that we have going on right now.
Well, it's funny that you say that because we just got a game for the GameCube called Mario Baseball.
Yeah.
And you know, I had to go through, they have tutorials that are built into the game on how to pitch and how to hit and how to field and that. And if I didn't go through those, my 9-year-old was just absolutely killing me.
Yeah, you know, and my son just turned 5, and we've now officially reached the point where he's beating me at games. So, last year I was letting him, and now I'm not letting him anymore, and he's still beating me. So.
Yeah, you know, it starts to get a little disconcerting there, but
I'm going to start hiding his controllers.
Now, on the BBS scene, you know, with the internet and with the retro computing craze that has been happening, there's some ways these days to access BBSs in, well, how would I call it? It's kind of the traditional way of accessing a BBS, but you're doing it over the internet. But instead of dialing a phone number, you've got a little converter that converts the serial on your retro computer over to an internet link like a Telnet link. And you just connect up and do that. I mean, what it's done for me is, since I didn't have as much participation in the BBS world before, I've got an opportunity now, almost like a second chance, to get on and experience this in the true retro fashion. So, but I was wondering if you've called any BBSs recently, if you know of any that are still around, or if it's just pretty much the internet for you these days.
Put the book out. The book came out in August of this year, or of last year, 2006. When I released the book, I had not. And the three complaints that people have given me, I don't know if it's complaints necessarily, but the three things that people have said that they wish that I had covered in the book are FidoNet, they wish that I had included more about the Amiga, and the big one is that I ended the book basically saying that BBSs were dead, and then everyone corrects me and says, no, there's still BBSs these days. You know, you just have to tell that into them and all this. Now, I had heard of that, but, you know, near the end of the book, there's a thing where, you know, basically I spend these, you know, 13 chapters talking about how much better BBSs were than the internet. I mean, you built this, there was this community, there was this camaraderie, it was local people, I mean, everything about the BBSs, when you look back, and I'm sure some of it is, you know, rose-tinted glasses, but when you look back, it just seems like that was so much greater. And then people ask me, would you trade it? Not a chance. There's no way I'm going back to that for the internet, just because the internet does everything that BBSs did better and faster. The one thing that BBSs had that the internet doesn't is that local community. You know, of course, since you were calling these things with your phone, it stands to reason that most of the BBSs you called were local to you. So most of the users that you ended up meeting were people that lived nearby you. So there was kind of that natural progression of, you know, meeting people online and then eventually meeting them in real life. And one of the things I covered in the book is, you know, a lot of the people that I met through BBSs, I'm still friends with today. You know, several of the people, Charon that was in the book, and Arcane, and these people, you know, that I use their aliases, were best men at my wedding. You know, they're people that I talk to on a daily basis. So those type of bonds were really strong, and that's something that I don't know that the internet does. But the point of that is that now with these, you know, BBSs that you can tell men into, that's the one thing that you're not getting, is it's not local people. It's still people from all over the world. So now you're doing stuff the way that we used to do it, but there's no point. You know, the forums on a BBS, I don't think work as well as internet forums or, you know, the file transfers and stuff. It is good. I think everybody should go do it. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is because as I'm 33 and I don't feel old. I don't feel like this was that long ago.
Right.
More and more, when I mention these stories to people, they're like, "You used your phone line?" And they looked at it like we were crazy that we were doing this, you know? So that's one really good thing about the book, is that, you know, it kind of appeals to, you know, people who were there and they had those shared memories. The people that weren't there, I've had a lot of comments from people. They're like, you know, I never really called boards, and it was crazy what your people were doing, you know? But anyway, so since the release of the book, I have started telnetting. A friend of mine runs a telnet BBS, and so I've telnetted into it. And one thing that's funny is it's amazing how quickly you forget. You know, like I've completely forgotten my way around a BBS, so I've had to relearn, you know, how the menus work and how to read posts. And one of the most frustrating things, and if you've done this, you know this, is that I'm using a Commodore 64 terminal on my PC.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'm using CG term, and it maps all of your keys on your PC like a Commodore keyboard. So, for example, on the Commodore keyboard, an apostrophe was Shift 7, which is not what that is on your PC keyboard. So if you hit the, you know, the actual apostrophe key, I think you get an asterisk or something. So, you know, your brain has to revert back, and that is something that really amazed me, is that within a couple of minutes, I remembered where these old keys were, you know. So,
oh, really? See, I didn't pick it up that fast.
It's a little bit of a learning curve.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I get on something like the Vice emulator,
mm-hmm, right, 64. Right, yeah, same thing, where, you know, if you're trying to do a quotation mark, and if you don't know that that's really Shift 2, you know, you're never going to find it.
Exactly. Oh, that's fun. But, you know, I know the sense of community was a big deal, too. I mean, a while back, there was a recreation of the Commodore Online system, Quantum Link. And, you know, a lot of people were excited about this. They were excited about seeing it again, excited about being able to emulate it, essentially. But one of the big things they were excited about was finding some of the old people who used to hang around Quantum Link.
Yeah, and that's, you know what, I have a link here, and I have to see if I can find it while we're talking, but yeah, there's actually a website now where you can go and you can look, people are entering in their old, like, BBSs.
Uh-huh.
Like BBSs you used to call, I think it's called BBS List, but you can do that, and then, you can sign up and put your name. So if there's an old BBS that you used to call, then you can, you know, you could go up there and look it up, and you can find other users who used to call it. And yeah, that's a really neat thing. And I knew they were doing that with Quantum Link too. It's just like what you said with the BBSs, though. I think there's that thing where people go, "Wow, I want to see what this is like." And then once they've seen it, I don't know that there's that longevity behind it. You know, you see it, and then you go, "Yeah, it was pretty bad. Boy, the internet's pretty cool."
Yeah. You know, one time I put, when I was doing something on communications, that I'm glad that people don't have to download the podcast at 300 baud.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a killer, you know. And there's a part in the book where I talk about Souls of Zero, the lit group that a friend of mine started, and a friend of mine and I started. And
oh, right, right, I remember that.
Yeah, and you know, basically it was a, now if we started it today, it would just be a web page, and it would be, you know, my friends and I writing short stories or whatever and posting them on a web page. But back then, you know, like we talked about, without that centralized, you know, system, basically what you did was you put it into a program of some sort, or, you know, what we had was a viewer and batch files and this thing that we had, you know, this big clunky package that we would zip up. But, yeah, like what you said is, you know, when we were done, we would start uploading it to BBSs, and people would have to download it. And, you know, after a while, you didn't want it just in your area code, you know, so you would have to, you know, my friend, you know, we got people that would call long distance for us and upload this thing, you know, and they would, you know, call us and these guys had, you know, phone bills in the hundreds of dollars every month, you know, because they were moving this file around for us. So, yeah, you know, downloading stuff at 300 baud, it took dedication. You know, it was really, you really wanted to do. I remember when I first started downloading stuff at 300 baud, I had just got a motorcycle and was riding it to school. And what I would do is in the morning, I would put a floppy disk in the Commodore and start downloading a game, and it would download to the front side of the disk, and I would go to school, and then at lunch we could leave. I would drive home, flip the disk over, and start downloading the second half of the game. I would go back to school, and it would, download throughout the afternoon, and when I would get home, it would just be finishing up, and then I'd have, one new game to play that day. So, yeah, it's almost, at 300 baud, even at 1200 baud, I could read faster than 1200 baud.
Yep.
So when you were on a BBS, and text is scrolling across at 1200 baud, you could read faster than it could give you the text. So you could give, based off that, you can have an idea of how slow it was, to download a program. And I remember when I first got 2400 baud, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. Who needs a modem this fast,
Well, yeah.
Faster than I can read. What am I going to do with this?
That's funny. One of the people on the BBS documentary said the same thing. They said, 300 baud was pretty cool. You could read as the text came across.
that's one thing that you were talking about, the Telnet BBS is that it really doesn't, I don't know, the terminal I'm using, I don't know if it has an option for that. I'll have to look, but I've noticed that a lot of the BBSs, when I connect to them, they just fly by, and you don't really have that sense of waiting. Because a lot about, old computers, whether it was, loading a game or, downloading a game or anything like that, it all involved waiting.
Yeah, you had to pay the bills.
Yeah, absolutely. The, one of my favorite stories that's in the book was about my dad's old TRS-80. And whenever we had it, we had a cassette drive on it. And one of the first games we had was a text adventure. And I think it was called Haunted House or Haunted Mansion or something like that. But the game took a half an hour to load. So you would load up this game for half an hour, and then you would play through the first half of the game. And then when you were done, when you got to the halfway point, it would say, now turn the cassette tape over. Turn it over, and you would load it for another half an hour. And then right at the first thing of the second half, there was this knife that was floating in midair. And it says, there's a knife in front of you. And no matter what you did, the knife would kill you.
Oh, no.
Yeah, if you said, go west or whatever, it'd say, nope, the knife is your throat. That's it, game over. And then it would say, please flip the tape over.
Oh, back to the beginning.
So not only did you have to play through the whole game, to get to that point, but you had an hour loading time broken up into these two half hours. And then it turned out the correct solution was get knife. If you type get knife, it would say, okay, you have the knife in your possession.
And no
that was the way around it. But
no internet to go out and find the clue book.
Exactly. You just had to figure this stuff out. But, yeah, so, I have seen, there's like we talked about on the new consoles, one of the things that people compare between the two is loading times. And they say, well, this game takes, 30 seconds, and this one's only 25 seconds, so this console must be better. And that's what I want to say. Well, this game, was 4K, and it took an hour.
Right. Right. Talk to me when you...
That's something that I do. You mentioned Vice, the Commodore 64 emulator, and it has that very handy Alt-W that throws you into warp speed.
The warp mode, yeah.
Yeah. When you're loading a game, it'll show that you're at 100%, and you hit Alt-W, and all of a sudden it shoots up to 2,000%. Load that game for you in just a few seconds, and we didn't have that back then.
And I got to admit, I use that. I use that today.
Yeah. with the faster computers get now, you just get so spoiled with that. Even, I'll go to a website, and boy, if something doesn't pop up in a couple of seconds, I just close it and go up. You go to the next one because we're just so used to things being instantaneous now.
We're conditioned on that. I mean, my link here at my house, my internet link through my phone company, mm-hmm. is they laid fiber in my neighborhood not too long ago.
Yeah.
So I've got a 15 megabit download speed. And, there's not that many sites that can even saturate that, that can even...
Right, that's pretty nice.
Do that, but, it's ridiculous. I remember when the whole corporate link for the company that I worked for was a T1, and we thought we were really uptown, man, with 1.5 megabits.
We have Cox Internet here, and they just recently, I think we're up to 7 now. They bumped us up from 5 to 7. And, it's just amazing, you know, the amount of data. There's a story in the book where I talk about, just like what I was saying earlier, you know, you're downloading this disk, and it would take, you know, 4 hours, and one side of a Commodore disk is about 180K.
Right.
And so, you know, when I first got my cable modem, I'm like, wow, I'm going to start, you know, finding all this stuff, and I found this CD that was full of Commodore games, and, you know, and I think the collection's grown since then, but, you know, at the time, it was like, okay, 10,000 games, and it's all in one CD, and you download it, you know, in half an hour or whatever, and I'm thinking, you know, before this would have taken me years.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
And, you know, the whole time I had a Commodore from the mid-80s until, you know, the early 90s or so, you know, I got my whole collection. I'd figured it up one time. It was about 700 discs, which if you, you know, include both sides and figure everything out, that's like about 230, 240 meg. So in half an hour, I downloaded 3 times what I was able to collect, you know, in 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, I agree. I got to agree with you on that. I'm not going back either.
Yeah, it's, we're just so, I don't know, like you said, conditioned to the speed. Oh, that site that I mentioned earlier is BBS Mates, just like classmates or something, bbsmates.com.
Oh, cool.
It says, there's currently 75,000 BBSs listed on there, and you can add, if there's a BBS you're looking for and it's not on there, you can add it. But you could go in there and search for, you know, maybe a local BBS or something that you used to call, and you can add your name there, and, you know, you can get in touch with people. And I've actually used this before. I mean, I found a couple people that I haven't talked to in 10 or 15 years, so it's kind of neat.
Well, you know, I've got a couple buddies of mine that were sysops. So I'm going to nudge them to get over there and register their BBS.
And you may find that one of their users already has, because there's a lot of them that have just been, you know, added from people that used to call.
That's true. Well, do you have any, it's been a great conversation. Do you have any parting shots here, Rob?
One thing that we didn't really talk about was, the retro computer community that's still around today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I still have my old Commodore. Upstairs I have I have a couple of different areas. I have, you know, one with all the video game consoles, and I have, you know, a lot of old ones and on all the way up, you know, to the newer stuff. But I have a little table area I've got an Apple IIe, which is hooked up, and then I have my Commodore, and I'm trying to, I have an Amiga hooked up now. And it's kind of funny, like what we were talking about, like WinVice and stuff, and having those things come back to you. I don't know that I'd be able to learn it today. You know, the Commodore stuff, you know, I did it for so long that the old disk commands and stuff, you know, they just kind of come back to me. But a couple of years ago, after having, you know, so many people told me, the Commodore was okay, but, you know, it was, the Amiga is really where it was at, you know. And so I picked up an Amiga, and I just feel like I'm fumbling around in it, you know. I've got, you know, I can load programs and stuff, but when it comes to, like, the command line stuff and everything, I just don't know that I'll ever pick it up. I think maybe when we were younger, you know, you were willing to dedicate a little bit more to it than I must be today.
No, I think that's true. I mean, the 64 was, well, first the VIC-20 and then the 64 were the machines that I had back in the day. And I was really kind of taken with the machine that a friend of mine had, a Commodore 128.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had one back then, but I do have one today. And it's one of my favorites, but I agree. It's got some of the extended commands and things like that where you don't have to use the open 8, comma, you know, yada yada to do things with the disk, but I'll still find myself doing those things.
Yeah,
still reverting back.
Big, it gets into a heated battle, people will they seem to be very into one or the other between keeping the old hardware alive to the emulation.
There is a lot of anxiety about that. I've seen comments on both sides of the aisle, you know, coming into the podcast.
And you know, I mean, I truly believe that the original hardware is better. You know, the like WinVice, there are things in WinVice that just don't look right or don't sound right, you know. And they're close, but they may not be 100% accurate, and it's amazing how picky your memory can be. You know, I'll remember a tune from a song from 20 years ago, and you pull it up and you go, oh, that doesn't sound right, you know.
An emulated SID just isn't a SID.
Right, right, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the difference is that emulation is certainly a lot more convenient. You know, I have the Commodore 64 emulator on my Xbox, and I could sit in my living room with my wireless controllers and sit back and play Paradroid and do things like that that I could never do, you know?
Right.
I go on trips for work, and I'm not going to lug an Apple IIe around with me all around the country, you know, to play games. But I have all those things on my laptop, and I can do that. So, you know, I've never really picked a particular... I could see both sides of that argument, you know, and I've had people on both sides, which, you know, they it's not that... If you agree with their side, that's not enough. You have to disagree with the other side.
Well, I'm afraid I can't pick sides either. I mean, there's, you know, a large contingent of folks who listen to the podcast that are from, you know, Europe and some from Asia and that kind of thing. And there are machines that were over there that didn't really make it to the States.
Sure, yeah. You know, there's a, if you look at, what's the magazine? The Retro, is it Retro Gamer?
Retro Gaming Monthly? Is that the one?
Yeah, yeah. You know, they always have huge articles on the Speccy, you know, and you know, it's just computers that never made it here or whatever, and you look at it and you go, well, why would that be popular, you know? But, and of course, whenever you talk to European Commodore people, you get into the debate of whether the disk drive was better than the cassette drive. I guess it was mainly a financial thing. I guess they were just, owning a disk drive was so cost prohibitive, in Europe, you know, that there's so many Commodore owners stuck with the data set, which over here was unheard of.
I mean, right.
Yeah, I think I mentioned in the book I had a data set for about 20 minutes. I'm not doing this, you know.
Excuse me.
We've graduated past that, so.
No, I had a C2N data set, and I guess the main reason for me was I started out on Commodore with the PET at high school, and not too many people liked it because of the chiclet keyboard. It had a funky keyboard, but I wanted computer time, so I was going to take what I could get. And one of the things that I found, you know, I'd done some cassette saving and loading on the Apple. I think I did it on the TRS-80, and it was hit and miss. Sometimes you just lose everything. But,
right.
Man,
yeah.
That Commodore data set was just the most reliable thing on earth. That was just bulletproof. So yeah, I had a love-hate relationship with it. I didn't like the time it took, but I liked the fact that I didn't figure it was going to eat my programs.
Right, right. And, you know, there are, you know, cassette programs from that Commodore that are still, you know, you could still buy them on eBay. So that stuff is still around, you know. One of the other things that I do, and that, you know, there are people, you know, I there's a whole scene of people doing this, and I didn't really realize this at the time, but, you know, there are a group of people that are dedicated to archiving all that old software. And you know, there are ways, either through cables or, you know, networks, different type of hacks or whatever, but, you know, there are ways of basically transferring those old disks, like the old Commodore disks, and turning them into the images that you can use on the emulators.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've done quite a bit of that. It's kind of slow, and it requires, you know, some special hardware and stuff, but that's one thing, I guess, that makes the emulation more acceptable to me is, you know, when I pull up the disks, it's still my old disks. You know what I mean? They still look familiar to me, even though it's on a different hardware platform.
Right, right. And, I mean, you're saving them for posterity.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of the things I have, you know, that are on those disks are, you know, like maybe buffers of chat captures and things like that, stuff that, that no one else in the world has, you know, or programs that I wrote and stuff like that. So, you know, that's kind of become, I'm kind of into that right now, is just archiving that stuff. And, you know, there's just like, if it's a game, you know, well, somebody's probably archived that game, so I'm not too worried about that. But when it comes to, you know, like my old BBS files, or, you know, my old terminal program that has all, you know, my old phone numbers and that kind of stuff, and I think that's kind of neat, and I think that's just kind of a snapshot, you know, of my particular history that's kind of neat to archive.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish I would have had the foresight to hang on to some of that stuff. I mean, I wrote some software in high school for the TRS-80 and the Apple II and that kind of thing. And, man, you know, just for fun, I wish I had some of that stuff still around.
Oh, yeah. And you know, conversely, you can take stuff and go the other way. And that's neat, too. You know, you could find these programs like, you know, D64 format or whatever, and you could take those and transfer those back onto real Commodore diskettes and then play it on an actual 64.
Yeah, the software package OpenCBM, I believe it is.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, the problem that I have an older X1541 cable, and I just got an XE, but the problem I've had problems. They seem to be pretty particular with the type of parallel port that you use it on.
Ah.
I have one computer that it works great on, and it's a 486. So I have this really old, clunky computer sitting in the corner, and that's all it does is I boot it up into DOS, and I transfer disks, you know, whenever I'm in the mood to do that. But, you know, there's all, I don't know if you've seen, like, the 1541-3. But it's a, basically, it's a Commodore disk that they are, that some homebrew guys are developing. And it's,
oh, yeah, yeah, I have seen that.
Yeah, and you'll be able to put in, like, you know, SD cards and stuff and load those D64 images directly onto a real C64. And I know that they have, like, the MMC64, and there's just lots of cool stuff. It was really a fun computer, and you know, the BBSs and all that, it just kind of ties it all together, you know. It was, you know, if you think about, well, the computer that you had maybe 5 years ago, there aren't people still dedicated to that, you know, but the BBS has just made such a strong impression on people that, you know, there are people that are still keeping all that stuff alive today, so it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's something about that older hardware that, you know, you can just sit down to it, and it just doesn't seem as intimidating. You know, when you look at that little Commodore, and it's in 40 columns, and it's just sitting there flashing at you, and you think, well, this is cute, you know, and you play some games, and you don't have to have a degree, you know, to get everything hooked up, and, you know, your network configured and everything like that, and there's, you know, there were no viruses, and there were, you know, no things like that, and it was just, like I said, just kind of a fun time, and I think, you know, you could go back to that, and people still enjoy it today.
Yeah, pure fun, no worries. I agree. And,
exactly.
And, you know, you could know everything practically that there was to know about a particular computer.
Yeah, you know, I guess once you picked up on the basics, there wasn't the learning curve that there is today. You know, there wasn't, you know, new operating systems being released or, you know, new technology. I mean, you know, the Commodore setup that I have upstairs today is essentially the one that I had, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, it's the same drive, it's the same computer, and actually it's the same monitor.
And I'm amazed after all those years that thing's still just chugging along for you.
You know, I have gone to thrift stores, and I'm always worried that someday that the hardware is going to give out, you know, and so when I find a 1541 or I find a Commodore power supply, I pick them up and I just hang on to them because I think, you know, well, someday I'm going to, you know, my drive's going to die and I'm going to need this. And believe it or not, you know, to this day, the drive has never died. It's still, everything is still working. So I think I've got enough spares now to last me for, you know, another 200 or 300 years.
Well, that's good.
I'm taking it all with me.
Excellent. Oh, man. Well, like I said, this has been a ton of fun.
Okay, well, yeah, man. I really appreciate it. And,
and, you know, let's keep in touch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got my email address and everything, and I'm in the process of working on a couple of other books, and it'll be about owning arcade games in your home.
Oh, okay.
And so, yeah, that might be something that we get back together and talk about later on down the road. And I'm probably shooting at the same time frame. I'd like to have it. I want to have it done maybe in the next 4 months, something like that. Like early, you know, late spring, early summer, something like that. You know, the one thing that's fun about self-publishing is there's no money up front. So if you write a book that only 20 people buy, you're not out anything. You know, right. I mean, except for your time, but if you're going to write it anyway, then, you know.
And you're also not working against the stress of getting an advance or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly, yeah. You know, you're writing what you want to write. But, you know, I've seen technical manuals on, you know, fixing arcade games and stuff, but I've never really seen anything about, you know, just kind of what it's like to buy arcade games, and trust me, it's a whole interesting animal. You meet some really interesting people, so I've got a lot of stories that I think will, you know, be kind of interesting to read through, and then, you know, a lot of it is just kind of like giving advice, like, you know, how to find arcade auctions, and what to take, like there are certain things, you know, you should take to an auction, and what to look for when you're buying a game. So it's just going to be kind of like that. It'll be, you know, it's not going to be real technically heavy. It'll be pretty lighthearted. It's kind of like Commodore is. So I think it'll be neat.
Yeah, well, I mean, that'd be fun. There's a lot of folks that listen to the podcast that are interested in gaming and retro gaming and that kind of thing. So, yeah, when that's done, we should chat again.
Oh, absolutely. I'll be looking forward to it.
You know, I almost forgot, though, for the listeners, if they're interested, man, how could I forget this? If they're interested in the book, what's the website they should go to?
Well, they could just go to robohara.com. That's me. And there's a subsection on there for Commodore. There's links to it on the front page, or you can just go to robohara.com /Commodore. And that's one of the really, really important things to me when I put this out was I wanted to stay connected with the people that were reading the book. I wanted to get feedback, and I've got great, great stories that people have emailed me, and as you saw in the book, you know, my MySpace is in the book. My MySpace is, you know, /Rob O'Hara. My website's in there. My email address is in there. So I've got, you know, just nothing but great feedback from people. So that was something that was really important to me, and was part of the BBS community and the online community, was, you know, talking to people. And so I didn't want people to think that, you know, I was just some stuffy person who somehow wrote a book or whatever, that, you know, this is really my story. And a lot of people, you know, have written me and said that it was neat. So that's been a really great part of it.
No, you were really open on the communication channel part there. I thought that was great.
Yeah. I figured, when I wrote the book, you know, I honestly figured that any statute of limitations, as long as it's expired, I don't think anybody cares about copying Commodore games anymore. So I figured I was safe on that. And
yeah, I don't think those three-letter agencies are going to come knocking on your door.
Yeah, and you know, that was the other consideration whenever I was writing it. The reason that I put other people's you know, use their aliases because I didn't want to drag anybody down with me.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's
funny. I figured, you know, if anybody were interested in these old sordid tales, that at least it would just be me, you know. But my dad actually did make a comment. He goes, "Boy, you made me out to be a nice guy. Here I am raising this kid and teaching him how to pirate games and everything else." I'm like, well, at least I don't mention your name, Dad.
Oh, that's good. But Rob O'Hara, that's robohara.com, right?
That's it.
Okay. Perfect. Well, excellent. Well, then I will chat with you in the near future.
Okay. Hey, man, drop me an email anytime. And, yeah, when I get closer to the, to that book thing, I'll definitely let you know. And you know, I'm making a note right here. I will, get back on the forums, because if, you know, if there's any feedback or anybody has any questions, or it might just stir up some good conversation, and so I'll be on there for that too.
Great. Well, yeah, we'll light up a thread on this one.
Yeah, sounds cool.
So Rob O'Hara, author of Commodore, Sordid Tales from a BBS Junkie. Rob, it's been really fun to talk with you. Thanks again.
Hey, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Sure. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, man. Take care.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's it for this week. Oh, man, thanks a million again to Rob for spending the time with us here. Very enjoyable, and woo, we're up at 45 minutes, so I'm going to close it out. If you'd like to get more information on the podcast, including the two links that I'll have up there for this week, jump on over to retrobits.libsyn.com. You can send email to retrobits@gmail.com, and our online interactive discussion forum is at retrobits.petsci.com. Hope you all have a fantastic week. I've got a variety show coming up for you next week, so be sure to tune in. And until then, take care. Bye-bye. Thank you.